Hello, everyone. Rabbi Kelman's going to be handling the screen here. Just a couple things before we begin. Incidentally, with all the talk about the UAE and everything, there's an article in tablets. Here it is. Am I the screen? I have to be the big screen, though. Am I the big screen now? Can you see me?
You can, sure, yeah. If okay. Everybody goes on to speaker view, they'll see.
A rabbi in Riyadh. It's an article about Rabbi David Rosen being received by the Saudi monarch. David Rosen, this rabbi, is the one that was the one at the beginning, if you recall, the interfaith service. He's the one, former rabbi in Ireland, as I recall. So that's him. Ruvain from Paris, I promised I would get to you. Actually, before I get to Ruvain from Paris, someone said, I think it was Shmuel, that there was no, that the Mechina in Tells did not have secular studies, and I said, I'm certain that's wrong. Well, here it is in the book Yadut Lita, Volume 2, page 1633, the article by Rabbi, by Dr. Holtzberg, who was the principal. He says that that Rabbi Bloch, Yosef Le Bloch, did not even was not pushed off even from putting secular studies in the Mechina in Tells. Why did they do that? Because the yeshiva students at Tells would be given an exemption of the from the army if they had 4 years of secular classes, and after that they would go and they would do this in the afternoon and the evening. And after that, they go into the yeshiva. So yes, the Mechina in Tells absolutely had secular studies. It's funny because right after I saw that, the next day, I was reading this book Masa Ish. It's a six volumes, or maybe seven stories of the Chazon Ish. And on page in volume 3, page 42, it's they're talking about they had a problem because this high school. Typical tichon where they have secular studies as well as Torah studies. Rabbi Dessler didn't know what to do because they asked, they approached and they wanted his assistance in opening up like a modern Orthodox school with Torah study and secular studies. And Rabbi Dessler didn't know what to do about that. Should he agree with it or not? And Rabbi Dessler had an idea that why don't we can help them out, but we can't call it a yeshiva because it's not a yeshiva, obviously, if they also take secular studies. And the Chazon Ish said that he thought that was not a good answer. He said, because it's Kivadai Zotia Yeshiva, because certainly it's a yeshiva. It's just, in his mind, it's just an improper yeshiva, but it's a yeshiva. And so he thought the best thing is not to involve themselves at all with that, because obviously then they'd be able to say that, you know, like Dessler approved a yeshiva with secular studies. Finally, Ruvain from Paris. I don't know if you're with me. I was supposed to get to this a number of weeks ago. It's good I waited, though, to after Tisha B'Av, because, and I'll get to the kashrus thing I want to speak about next week. This interesting phenomenon I spoke about a couple weeks ago with Rav Schechter, that this idea that in the briskers, among the briskers, they don't take fasts as seriously as the rest of us do. And you don't have anything written about this. This is sort of like Torah Shabbat Peh. It's an underground thing. I wrote about this a little while ago on the Sfarim blog, but then I quoted the Rizhin, what they do in the Rizhin dynasty, and you have all these ideas. In fact, you have, and it's mostly among the Hasidic type poskim that are very mako for women on fast days in opposition to what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. But what about men? So I told you what Rav Schechter said, and I said some other things. So Ruvain from Paris tells me that he learned at Makor Chayim, which used to be in Borough Park and now is in Lakewood. And the Rosh Yeshiva there was Rav Binyamin, I think it's a Power or Paler. He was a, his father was, he was the Talmud of Ravelvel Soloveitchik. And he tells me as follows that, and he got this actually from his brother, whose brother was there. They once were building the Rosh Yeshiva Sukkah on Som Gedalia, and the Rebbetzin comes out with cookies. And the brother tells the story that, and when the students all refused, she said, oh yeah, you're fasting. It's an amazing thing. And he, Ruvain, not his brother, when he was there, he spoke to Rav Yitzchak Paller, who was the firstborn of Rabbi Yamin, who suddenly passed away, he says, 2 years ago. What's the justification for this? Rabbi Kelman, we got to mute everyone. So what's the justification for this? And this is Reuven writing. He wasn't really sure. He tried to justify it, saying it's better to eat than learn and fast and not learn. And then he said that he asked Rav Yitzchak Paller, who's the student Talmud of the Griz. And he told them the following story, that once on the 17th of Tammuz, a group of yeshiva bachrim went to the Catskills to visit a rabbi there. He thinks it was from Torah Vadas. And he said, why are you here not learning? And they said that he can't learn because they're fasting. And he said, it's better to learn. He also points out that Rabbi Basri, whose responsa we've dealt with, we'll get back to him, says the exact opposite, that there's no such concept that if you can't learn, you're not supposed to fast. But we see that there's this sort of underground tradition. And finally, there's someone in Lakewood. He comments on my Sfarim blog post. This is a quote from him. I once spoke to the Brisker Rav's grandson. He learned in Brisk. Namesake, and Yitzhak Zev, son of Rav David, about this. He said, and this is the Brisker Rav's grandson, the son of Rav David, Meshulam David, Yitzhak Zev. He said he personally doesn't fast other than Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur for the reason that I cited, namely that we all have the status of being sick for fasting purposes. And he said that his father wouldn't object if he ate on Tisha B'Av as well. I asked how far back this goes, and he said Rav Chaim Brisker came up with it, but his father, the Beis HaLevi, fasted all the regular fasts, plus others as well. So I find this all unbelievable that you have, and we're not dealing with liberal Jews here. We're not dealing with modern Orthodox. We're dealing with really extremists when you think about it. They're anti-Zionists, most of them, and the center of Torah study, to go to Brisk is considered like the ultimate. And some people can't get a shidduch unless you go to Brisk. And then you have among them, as we speak, people who don't really hold to the fast so much. And then finally, just one more thing, there's a Machaber Sefer. I'm not going to say his name. I don't know if he made it public. And the Talmidei Chachamim listening to us would know who he is. He comes from Hasidic background. There's some others listening who know who he is because they were there with me when it happened. He told me on the fast days, he told me Asar B'Tavis, so I assume it applies to everything other than Tisha B'Av, obviously Yom Kippur. He said that he only fasts till Mincha. And he said that was his father's minhag in Europe already. His father was a Hasidic, was a Chassid, and then Eretz Yisrael. His father's in Eretz Yisrael, actually, a Chassid. And this is a Mechaber Sefer, a Talmud Chacham, who many people have heard of his. And he just said to me, and it wasn't even an issue. It wasn't because he said he felt ill or anything. He just said, that's our minhag. So this, whether this is ever going to make it out of the shadows, but I find it really something. Okay, a couple more things. One more thing I want to say before we get going, because, let's get going. Back to Rav Amsalam. You could put his picture on the screen again, Rabbi Kelman. Put Rabbi Amsalam on the screen here, if you can. I'll keep talking. I gave you a nice introduction to Rabbi Amsalam. I also said that because he was pushed out of the right-wing world, the Haredi world, I should say, sorry, the Haredi world, but still the Haredi world, he moved to the liberal world. And that's often a phenomenon. If you don't have a community in one place, you go where there is a community. So if you look online, you can find pictures of Rabbi Amsalam sitting on the Beis Din for conversion with Rabbi Riskin and others. But to show you how far he's gone, before we pick up with his response among conversion, just two things that came out in the last 2 weeks. I'm now on his distribution list. The first thing is, and I could send this to anyone, he was asked by the rabbi of the Kehillah Sfaradit in Seattle. Now, I don't know what this means because there's two Sephardic communities in Seattle. There's two big shuls. What to do with Rosh Hashanah coming up in Yom Kippur? People, they can't have Shminyan. Unlike in Borough Park in Lakewood, where they're back, they have basically herd immunity, they're having shul there, no masks, no shaking hands, no social distancing. My friend called me, he left a message for me. He was at a wedding. I think he's on with us now in Lakewood. And I've heard from other people. It's as if nothing happened. But in the more modern shuls, we're not going inside. There's distancing, etc. What to do? Can you use video conferencing? We know about the Zoom Seder. And we saw Rav Schechter. Rav Schechter has a problem because Rav Schechter says it's like kasiva. It's like writing. this is an unusual position, that because you move and then it causes something to appear on the screen. I don't think others are hold of this. It is true that we, and Rav Schechter wouldn't have an issue with this, we all walk on the streets and there's videos, there's security videos, but we don't intend it. It's different, I guess, in davening, we intend for them to see us, so that would be different. But I know that many wouldn't hold, I mean, if you're just watching a screen, I know many would have a different position. In any event, Rabbi Amsalem says as follows, and I find this amazing, because we hear about the conservatives, they do this, but for Orthodox to do it, he says it's not a problem at all. The Sephardic rabbis, the North Africans, already permitted electricity on Yom Tov. This isn't even electricity, he says. Is he speaking at Yom Kippur as well? Let me see here. The question is Yemei Tishrei. So I don't know. He's definitely speaking about Rosh Hashanah. It's not clear here to me whether he's speaking about Yom, because Yom Kippur would be like Shabbos. It would be Yom Kippur either. Also, because he says Shabbos. He says, first of all, it's not an issue. It's on. He says, no different than a Shabbos clock or a Shabbos elevator. The video screen is already on. You're sitting at your house, you're watching it. No one's doing anything. And it's not such a strange view when you think just without, obviously in practice, it's strange. But last year, this Hasidic group, a big Hasidic group in Jerusalem, I'm not sure if it was Bells or Fishnitz, they had a non-Jew videotape their Yom Tov davening. And then they showed it online and, with all the singing and everything. And when people criticized, it became a mini scandal. This was on Kikar Shabbat. They said it's not a problem because a non-Jew was videoing it. But they wanted people to see the Ruach and you know where this will lead to in Ladavar Sof if we permit this. Then bar mitzvahs, you could have a non-Jewish photographer come in and video the bar mitzvah on Shabbos. I think it's a terrible thing and who knows what it's going to lead to. But he makes the case that this is just the video's on beforehand. It's no big deal. No one's doing anything. He obviously doesn't believe in the idea of kasiva, Rav Schechter. And that's his psak halacha lemaisa. And we're not dealing with a conservative rabbi here. I'll send this to anyone who's interested. The second tshuva that came out deals with conversion. That's what we're going to get to right away. It's to a rabbi in Chicago. I asked Daniel from Chicago, who's, if he's not with us now, he was with us last week. He listens to it on afterwards or live. Yoav ben Lulu. That's the name in Chicago. And the question was about Gior. Can local rabbinates do Gior? Because the chief rabbinate doesn't accept it. And as you can expect from what we said last week, Rabbi Amsalem says this is nonsense. The chief rabbinate, if they accept or don't accept, it only has to do with Israel policy, political things. But halacha is, if a Beis Din, and it can be based in Hadyotos, doesn't have to be rabbis even, convert someone, it's a valid conversion. And he says, if they mean that it's really not a valid conversion, he thinks this is pure rishus, evil, because then it means that they don't fast on Yom Kippur. It means that someone who's married can just leave his wife and she doesn't need a get. And that's the latest tshuva. And he says, you know, how many batei dinim there are private? There's Rabbi Rosen. He was the head of Somet. You saw Rosen, Rav Karelitz. Rav Karelitz is from Bnei Brak. Rabbi Steinsaltz, he says Zatzal. So there's been a number of private courts. So let's get back to the issue of Rabbi Amsalem. I introduced last week his approach to conversion. Someone in the questions pointed out this idea of Zera Yisrael, that's the name of his book, that this is found also among the dispute between Israel Hildesheimer and Sfirash Kalischer. I actually pulled it out yesterday. And I mentioned there's Kabbalistic angle here from Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, who believes that if you have a Jewish father and a Jewish mother, there's still some Jewish connection. It's true. He doesn't only argue Kabbalistically, but he does argue Kabbalistically. He brings just general proofs. It talks about, for instance, that there's sources. Let me read to you here something. Ezra. Remember the story of Ezra? He speaks about the Hisarvu Zera Kodesh, Ezra speaks about that the Holy See is going to be mixed with the non-Jews. Rabbi Hildesheimer replies, he's not referring to the descendants. He's referring to the actual seed of the Jew who's married to the non-Jew. Rabbi Sirish Kalischer says otherwise. And then Rabbi Sirish Kalischer quotes a Zohar that talks about how Yishmael had zechuyos that were given to him from being the son of Avraham. And the whole, what's the Zohar talking about? If his mother's not Jewish, then what type of zechus is there? And the Zohar speaks about the yichus, and it's a yichus from the father. But so therefore, Rav Sirish Kalischer argues, we see from the Zohar, because of Yishmael, and not just Yishmael, Yishmael's descendants, that they had a certain, because of the yichus, their zechus would bring them good things in this world. So what does Rav Israel Hildesheimer reply to this? This Zohar, he says as follows. This is in the Tshuvas of Israel Hildesheimer, volume 1, page 282. He says, what you brought from the Zohar, Englishum Yadiyah, Lassar Kamoni Daibliyum Benigo. He says, I can't comment on the Zohar. I'm just telling you halacha and this idea that you say that someone who has a Jewish father, non-Jewish mother, there's some sort of quasi-Jewishness that we try to be in the close. As Israel Hildesheimer says, there's no halacha about this, and I don't know about this Zohar, and we don't decide halacha based on the Zohar. So here now we are through Ramsam. What was my question to him? This is, we're on Simon Nunhei. One more thing about Ramsam. I mistakenly said that he blamed Aryeh Deri for being kicked out of Shas. It wasn't Aryeh Deri, it was Eli Yishai. I wrote to Rav Chaim Ramsam a letter when I got his book. I was very impressed. I thought, if you don't agree with all the conclusions, it's a real work of scholarship. I encourage everyone who's interested in the issue to look at it. One of the people who listens to it, Nachum Shemaria, his father, Big Tam HaChacham in Chabad, has a whole kuntris against Rabbi Ramsam. But it's worth seeing all of them. I wrote to him as follows, which I think is an important point that I haven't seen anyone make. Obviously, there's a dispute on this whole matter, which we spoke about. Can you convert someone if you're not certain how much they're going to observe of mitzvot? You have the liberal, the super liberal position of Rav Uziel, the Mishpatei Uziel, the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel, and the Sephardic chief rabbi, in which he holds, it really doesn't matter what they're going to do. It only matters what they say. If privately they don't intend to observe mitzvot, that's not our concern. That's a position that's not really accepted really by anyone, including not even by Rav Amsalem. And you have the more stringent position that you have to do everything, and if you don't, the conversion might not be valid. Then you have the mainstream position somewhere in the middle. You have to try to do your best. Doesn't mean you're going to do all the mitzvot. It means, we serve Rabbi Mazuz. He says it's enough to be traditional. Try to observe Shabbos, to send your kids to a Jewish school, etc., etc. And then you have the, even among the people who are stringent, then what about b'diavad? What about after the fact? That is, we will not convert someone if we're not convinced that they're going to at least be traditional or even orthodox. But what happened if they fool us? And it turns out that they're not observant. Then most people would say, after the fact, b'diavad, it's still valid conversion. I myself asked about such a conversion where someone converted and it was complete fraudulence, and the Rabbi Peretz Steinberg, who explained the whole situation, he was the one who did the conversion. I think he's a Talmud of Ramosha, the Vod of Queens. He said that this person is a sinning Jew. It's a valid conversion. Because we saw the Rambam. Remember the Rambam we saw last week, that the wives of Shlomo, they hid the fact that they were still going to worship idols, and they did worship idols, and yet b'diavad, the Rambam says it's still a valid conversion. So those are the major positions. I wrote as follows to Rabbi Amsal. I think that the position that holds b'diavad, it's a valid conversion, is much bigger than everyone is giving credit for. That is, it's not like many people say, it's like evenly divided. And there are big authorities on both sides. In fact, Rav Kook is on both sides. If you remember, was it Lightbeer from Miller? He used to say, I feel strongly both ways. He felt strongly both ways. Because in one tshuva, Rav Kook says, if someone converts and we see afterwards that they're not observant, it's an invalid conversion. But then he has another tshuva with this very similar case. And he says, no, we don't care. Dvarim shebelev einam dvarim. So maybe he couldn't come to a conclusion. What did I point out? Well, you have many responses by rabbis in which they say as follows, that we can only convert people if they're going to observe Torah and mitzvot completely. So you might think, well, that's a stringent position. But it really isn't, because the reason these rabbis give, and I can give you a list of them, is they say as follows. Because if we convert these people and they are not observant of Torah and mitzvos, then they're in a worse situation now than they were before. Before, they were a goy. They didn't have to keep kosher. They didn't have to keep Shabbos. They just had to follow the Shabbos mitzvos. Now that we've converted them and they're violating these things, they're considered sinners. And they're chotim, whereas before they weren't chotim. What does this show you? This shows you that they feel that these people who convert, even though they're not observing, the conversion is chal. It's a valid conversion. And we can't convert them unless we know they're going to be observant, because we're going to convert them. It's a valid conversion, and then they're chotim. That shows that they believe the conversion is valid. Rav Uziel thought, doesn't matter. It's better to be a sinning Jew than to be a non-Jew. But that's not really an accepted position. Almost everyone, the Sri Deish, oh, so many people write that it's better to be a non-Jew than a sitting Jew. And that's why they're very machmir on conversion, because they acknowledge that if you convert the person and the person isn't observant, they're sinning. Rav Moshe holds that it's also better to be a sinning Jew than a non-Jew, but only if you don't know any better. That's why Rav Moshe held you can convert all children, even if they're in completely irreligious families, because they'll grow up, they're like an onus, they're tino shenishpo, and they're not responsible for their actions, and it's better to be a Jew who doesn't know anything and violates everything than to be a non-Jew, because it's a special aspect of being a Jew. But he wasn't referring to adults who convert. Although Rav Moshe himself, in one of his tshuva, he has different positions. In one of them, he's melamed tzchus. He says, I don't do conversions like this, but I understand the rabbis who do it, why they do it. That is, conversions where the people are not observant. So it's not a simple matter, at all. And, we have RCA members here. Today, you can't convert if you're a member of the RCA unless they have special conversion courts. So you should ask a shaila. So what does this mean? If someone who's a member of the RCA goes ahead and does the conversion, you're going to say it's not a valid conversion ex post facto. How could it not be a valid conversion? It reminds me of when they said that they used to make these takonos that you couldn't get married unless you had a minion there and unless the rabbi was there and all this, because they were afraid of people, just a boy and a girl would just get married on their own. But if you went ahead and did get married, at least all the Ashkenazic post scheme assumed it's a valid marriage. In the Sephardic world, they held that the takona, it's not a valid marriage. So I asked this to Rav Amsel, and he replies to me as follows. He's happy that I enjoyed his book, that I agree with him generally, because I do agree. Well, who am I to agree? It's not for me to agree. I'm not a post-sake or anything, but I from historically, it's almost impossible. I've never seen a case where you can void a conversion years after marriage. We do know about voided conversions. It's not true what some of the liberal Orthodox say, that there's no such concept of voiding a conversion. That's false. We have examples of it. I mentioned Rav Kook is one example of it. But the idea that 15 years later, never heard of such a thing. But and then he goes on and he points out, we accept the idea of their kulam gerim, ex post facto, they're all considered converts. Just continue with the stuff I spoke about. But towards the middle of his response, he quotes Rav Shlomo David Kahana. Rabbi Kelman, can you pull him up on the screen? Kahana.
And it'll take me a second because okay. I got to open who the is, while you speak, I'll find it.
Yes, okay. It's the top or second to top one there. It says Kahana. Right underneath it, just click on it.
No, but
it's top one. Rav Shlomo David Kahana. Rav Shlomo David Kahana was one of the big rabbis.
It doesn't open. The link doesn't work.
Oh, the link doesn't work?
The link doesn't work.
Okay, the link doesn't work. You know what? It's funny, the link doesn't work. It's... it's a picture from so you won't see his picture. It's a picture from an auction catalog, and it takes you away from the website to something else. That's why it's not working. Okay, we won't see it. He has a long beard and looks very rabbinic. He was the leading rav in Warsaw before the war. He was able to escape in 1940. His son was Shmuel Zanvel Kahana. He was a big Zionist, Mizrahi person, was involved in the Ministry of Religion, I believe. He was able to get his father out in 1940, which is really late, through Trieste in Italy. He was on the same boat with Rav Itchemeyer Levin. If you remember Itchemeyer Levin, we spoke about, I think it was last week, the Aguda person who refused to go to the Aguda convention. in Jerusalem and writes him a letter explaining all the terrible things the Aguda did. And Rav Itzhak Meir Levin, I said, though he had nothing to do with that, but Tzvi Yehuda was holding him responsible because he was now the leader of the Aguda. But Rav Itzhak Meir Levin signed the Declaration of Independence. And it's an unbelievable thing. The more I read about that book I showed you last week, I really admire Rav Itzhak Meir Levin, because the Gera Hasidim as a whole really pushed this issue. They were the ones who turned the Aguda around into joining the Israeli government. And they really, the faction of Richard Meir Levin really was proud of the state of Israel and really wanted to have a part of it. And with the Aguda, every generation you have different leaders, but Richard Meir Levin, I think, I feel bad that Rav Tzvi Yehuda wrote so strongly to him, because the Gera Hasidim were big admirers of Cook. He didn't have nothing to do with that. But he was on the same boat. And then he becomes the Rav of the old city of Jerusalem. And when the old city surrenders, he has to leave. And he lives until 1953. He was an expert in Agunas, one of the real great poskim in Eretz Yisrael in the mid-20th century. Well, he has a tshuva. And he says as follows, and this is not just the tshuva, this is telling you what the leading Rav of Warsaw, the leading posek in Warsaw before the war, says. And then he was the posek zaken, the zaken aposkim in Eretz Yisrael in 1948, 49, 50. He dealt with all the Aguna questions. He says, even though it troubles us, the yediyah seinu shekol inan gerusam hushlash bishvil ishu, so bishvil Amana, you know, the only reason they're converting is because of marriage. They're going to get something out of it. Or Aliyah Eretz Yisrael, they're converting so they can get out of Europe and go to Israel. That is, they're married to someone, but they don't care about about Judaism. He says we have to accept them. Why? Because if they fool us and they say they accept the Olam Mitzvos, what do we know? We can't read inside their heads. He says the main thing, the ikar, is hatfilah b'mikvah k'sheira b'fnei beis hamikdash. If they go to the mikvah, if they say that they accept Torah, and then we find out later they don't, it doesn't matter, because again, dvarim shebelev einam dvarim. They went through the motions. They fooled us. This is troubling. We maybe had suspicions. He said they wouldn't mean it, but after the fact, it's a conversion. And then he concludes that therefore, based on all this, he says, this is what people did, from the Achronim, basically, this is what they all would do. And he says, therefore, if one is from Mizrahi Yisrael, a Russian, whose father is Jewish and mother's not Jewish, yesh makom hakel bo, yoter migir stamgoy, he says, well, he's not even dealing with, Amsalm is not talking about converting people just out of the blue. He's talking about people who have some sort of connection. And then he ends it saying that I had sent to him a letter from Rabbi Ben Sion Cuenca. You can pull up Rabbi Cuenca on the screen.
We'll try.
In the Sephardic world, they know who Rabbi Cuenca is. He was born in Eretz Yisrael. He was a big posek among the Sephardim. Let's see if we can get his picture up. He looks like the family comes from Spain originally. And if you click on it, does anything happen? Does it open up?
It's coming.
There he is, Ben Sion Avraham Cuenca. He edited a Torah journal for many, many years, which people from all over the world, the name of the Torah journal escapes me now. Hamasef. That ran for about 25 years, and rabbis from Eretz Yisrael, from America, from Europe, everyone sent articles into that. And I found in one of the archives in Israel a letter that he wrote to Rav Uziel, also with a very liberal view of conversion. Convert this soldier, as I recall, who wanted to marry this Jewish girl. They were going to live in a Jewish community, so they'll be traditional. And he thanks me for that. So I think we can conclude, and you can remove the picture now, Rabbi Kelman. I think we can conclude that this is a dispute. And I don't know. I mean, it depends which side you're inclined to. But there's no. It's not even an issue of right wing, left wing. Rav Shlomo David Kahana is not left wing. It's not. Rav Moshe Feinstein is not left wing. Rav Moshe Feinstein says you can convert all the children. It's not a question. It's just a question of how. First of all, how to look at halacha in these matters, what sources to use, and second of all, what your inclination is. If you're a Zionist type of posek today, there was a, you can find a debate online, a discussion with Ramosha Lichtenstein, who's also a Zionist, and he recognizes the problem, although he's not as liberal as Rabbi Stav. But if you're a Zionist post-Sikh, you know that there's a problem here, because in Eretz Yisrael, the state of Israel is important to you, and you have all these Russians who are not halachically Jewish. You're going to be motivated. You're going to want to do something for that. So that's an important, this issue is not going away. It's going to continue. And okay, we'll leave it at that. But it's Rav Amsalam, when the history is written about the issue of conversion, he'll be written about. I see, I forgot to mention, on my desk here, I have this book. It's Tokfo Shel Yosef Masas. Because Rabbi Amsalam has moved to the left, he discovered this Rav Yosef Masas, who we've mentioned a few times. We're going to come back to him probably next week. The very liberal posek from Meknes and later in Algeria, actually born in Meknes, then in Algeria, then back in Meknes. It's a whole book devoted to Rav Yosef Masas. It's a collection of his psakim. Because Rav Amsalam sees Rav Yosef Masas as an example of what a posek today should be. Thinks the Ashkenazim have destroyed the Sephardic approach to Pesach. We'll leave it at that. Okay, Simon, we have three more, I guess, in Yoredeya. Simon Kuf, Nunvav, page 131, back to Rabbi Feinhandler. Yisrael Pesach Feinhandler, he was an American rabbi who went to Israel. I had this simple question, but interesting question. I asked him, if a convert converts, a person converts to Judaism, does the first question, do they need to tovel the dishes? You have all these questions about converts. And so for instance, let's say a non-Jew, right before his conversion, touches the wine that's not levushal, and then he converts. Can he drink the wine? The question is machal Shabbos. The poskim have discussed, can a machal, so let's assume now for a minute that a machal Shabbos can't touch wine that's not levushal. That is generally how the OU and the others go. But Rav Yaakov Ettlinger famously said that no, it doesn't apply anymore because they're not really Rishayim. They just don't know any better. I can tell you also that I saw it with my own eyes. So when I was in Israel at the Inbo Hotel, and then again, I had Friday night dinner at the Mamila Hotel. So they have a Jewish person come out to pour the wine, and the wine is not mevushal. But the Jewish person, you could see, is not a Shomer Shabbos. At the Mamilla, was a guy with tattoos pouring it, and at the Inbal, just was a regular woman in pants Friday night, and a regular worker there. In fact, her, I knew for a fact, I saw her writing on Shabbos. But they're not Shomer Shabbos. You can look at them, and they wouldn't be working at the hotel Friday night. So what's going on here? I asked the Mashkiach at the Inbal Hotel. He says, we rely in the hotel on the position that a Machal Shabbos today does not make a wine not undrinkable. And there's good reason for that, quite apart from Ettlinger, because you can marry the child of Machal Shabbos. The whole issue is we were worried about conversions, intermarriages between Jews and non-Jews, but you can marry the child of Machal Shabbos. Having said that, the hashkachas in America and Canada, I'm sure, are very makpid that they will only allow a Shomer Shabbos Jew to pour the wine. So let's assume that that's halacha for now. Many poskim have discussed, can a Machal Shabbos drink wine? Because when he touches the wine, he can't drink it. Now, obviously, the Machal Shabbos is not interested in asking the question because he's a Machal Shabbos. But from a intellectual question, it's very interesting. Can a Machal Shabbos, there's a very good Chakira. If you have 10 Machal Shabbos together, are they considered Machal Shabbos? Because Machal Shabbos has to be for Hesya. If you have 10 Machal Shabbos is there, they're not considered valid Eidim. And therefore, 11 Machal Shabbos all doing in front of each other, they're not really Machal Shabbos, because by definition, they can't be Machal Shabbos because they're each Machal Shabbos. It's like an internal paradox. So we know sometimes with the convert, there are changes. All the poskim assume that a convert is allowed to hug his mother and child and things like that. Why do they say that? A convert is like a new person. if you say it's a new person, you'd say that they're like no connection. But they all assume, even though, as far as I know, there's no source that says this at all. And the only people to discuss this are the Achronim. And when I say Achronim, I mean 20th century. They all say that because biologically there's no Yetzer Hara, therefore there's no connection, there's no issue of Yichud, no issue of Negi or anything. Now, I know someone's going to listen. We have a lot of learned people, and I thank you, Rabbi Yitzhak Rice from the from Long Island has been sending me, he's watching on YouTube, he's sending me all sorts of things. I can recommend to Shirim and YU Torah, he's discussing a lot of the same issues we're discussing. So someone's going to send me some post-sake who says that someone who converts cannot be alone with the parents. But the mainstream post-scheme, there's an article in the Journal of Halakha and Contemporary Society years ago, you can see this all over, that that's what they assume. But what about in this case, about a toveling dishes? So Rabbi Feinhander, in just in two paragraphs, says absolutely, they do have to tovel the dishes, and he cites the Rashba. The Rashba says that the whole reason for toveling dishes, he cites the Yerushalmi, because the dishes, they've moved out from Tumas Ovdei Kochavim v'nichlesu Kedushas Yisrael. It's like it's left the idolatrous realm and entered into the holy realm. Well, since that's the case, obviously the non-Jew was in that realm, and now he's not. So therefore, you need tefillah. As far as I know, everyone believes that's the psalm. Now, the second question I asked him was also of interest, different. I've been to Egypt three times. I think that it was the very first class, if not the first class, the second class, but I think it's the first class of this series. I showed you a picture of myself and Rabbi Ari Zivotofsky right in front of the pyramids. First time I went, it was in Israel, my year in Israel. I don't know if today anyone who's learning in Israel on their breaks do that. In those days, very easy. You just hopped on a bus and it took you through Sinai and you went there today. Sinai, you have all the terrorists in Sinai. I guess you could fly if you want. I think, though, the yeshivas, Egypt is a problem. A lot of people feel it's a problem. I don't know if it's a problem. I'll go there. But I think they'll be flying to the UAE before my daughter was at Lindenbaum last year, and she's going to be in Lindenbaum on Wednesday. She's flying back because she's in, unlike my university, you see where I am, I'm at Scranton. We have school because we're not one of the Ivies. My daughter's supposed to be at Princeton, but Princeton decided no school, just online. So she's flying, but I'm supposed to pay for that. For Zoom. It's one thing, we come once a week, but you guys are getting a great deal here. I want you all to donate something for Torah in Motion. Rabbi Kelman's very generous. He puts it on YouTube now, and we should all donate something, but I don't think you're going to be paying $50,000, even if I do it four times a week. So she's flying back tomorrow night to Lindenbaum. Well, one of the Rabbanites, that's what they call them. In America, you can't call a woman who's a scholar a Rabbanit, or else the OU and the RCA, they'll come after you. But in Israel, they're all Rabbanites. No one has a problem with it. And they don't even have smicha. They just are Torah scholars. So one of the Rabbanites flew to the UAE last year for Rosh Hashanah to be one of, to not to lead the service, because you need the man for that, but she gave Divrei Torah and gave classes. So you have a whole community in the UAE, and maybe Torah in Motion, one day we'll get out there for a trip to the UAE. But can you go to Egypt? The Rambam says that you can't return to Egypt. Well, let's see what the Rambam actually says. Does he say that? The Rambam says, I will get back to this with Rabbi Rasabi in a minute, but I asked a question on the Rambam. The second part. The Rambam says in Hilchos Malachim, chapter 5, Halacha 8, he says, it appears to me, Yira'eli. What does that mean when the Rambam says it appears to me? Generally, we assume what Yira'eli means is that there is no explicit proof for the Rambam in the Gemara. There's no explicit proof in the Gemara or the Tosefta or anything like that. The Rambam derives it. Other things are explicit, the Rambam derives it. It's not so pashut as we say in yeshiva, because there's plenty of things where you don't seem to have an explicit proof and the Rambam derives it, it seems, and he doesn't say Yira'eli. But it's not that the Rambam makes it up or just on his own comes up with this. He seems to base it on something. That's what generally they say. So the Rambam says it, and you have to then figure out where he derives it from. The Aderist, Rav Kook's father-in-law, has a whole sefer on this, on these Yira'elis in the Rambam to show where he gets it from. So the Rambam says, it appears to me that if a king of Israel, Ariel Sharon, let's say, conquers Mitzrayim, because they're allowed to conquer Mitzrayim if there's a war, through a Beis Din, there has to be a Beis Din, you can't just, Jewish wars, you can't just go to war. You have to go to get approval from the Sanhedrin. that's, they said it's permissible. Then it's permissible to go back. And it says, the Rambam says, the prohibition of returning to Egypt, Rambam says, is only if individuals return on your own, or if you return there and it's in the hands of the non-Jews. We're going to return to what the Rambam says later on in the Frit Shetshuva, because how then can the Rambam live in Egypt? Other people disagree with the Rambam. I'll give you a whole list who hold that the prohibition no longer applies at all anymore today. It only applied in the days when they were idolaters, not if they're Muslims. It only applied before Sancheiriv messed them up. There's a million heterim to go to live in Egypt. But everyone holds that you can go visit. Why? Because the Gemara says explicitly, the Yerushalmi, it says, L'yeshiva i'ata chozer. It says you can't dwell in Egypt. You can visit, but you can't dwell. But you can return for scharot, for business, for pragmatia, and to conquer the land. And we'll see with Rav Ratzabi why it applies not just to these, but to everything that's temporary. That is, you can go visit Egypt. It's never, even according to the Rambam, who seems to hold that in today's day and age it applies, you could visit. So my question for Rabbi Feinhander was, how could the Rambam say, it appears to me, if a Jewish king conquers Egypt, you can live there? The Yerushalmi states explicitly, it's an explicit Yerushalmi that you're allowed to return to Egypt to conquer it. So why does the Rambam say that it appears to me? And he gives a very good explanation. He says that you can explain the Yerushalmi as meaning that only when you're conquering it, you can go there for the purpose of conquering it. But as soon as you conquer it, then you have to leave. That is, you conquer it like Sharon did, you take it over, and then you have to go back and make peace or whatever you need to do, but you can't remain there permanently. You can't make settlements or anything like that. So the Rambam, however, is telling us, no, that if you conquer it, if the Jews were to go and conquer Egypt, you can then settle there permanently. That's what Rabbi Feinhander says. That's a chiddush. And that's the Yerushalmi. It's not explicit in the Yerushalmi. Okay. End of Tshuva Nunvav. Tshuva Nunzayin is back to Rabbi Greenblatt, Ephraim Greenblatt, who we have so many tshuvot from, and we'll have so many more. Not only do we have so many more, next week we'll get to the very first tshuva on Eben Ezer, which two Dayanim mentioned that they are shocked at this tshuva, what Rabbi Greenblatt said. And the other Talmidei Chachamim didn't see an issue with it at all. It shows you, we'll see that Dayanim are sensitive to things, and I think you will find it a radical tshuva of Rabbi Greenblatt. But we'll get to that. I see we won't get into this class. I asked him a simple question. I looked online the other day, and it's one of these issues. The answer is, whatever you do, you do. You're always right, because Avid Kamar Avid. You have a big closet that requires a mezuzah. Has to be somewhat big to require a mezuzah. Which side do you put it in? Do you put it in the side going in where your clothes are, or do you put it in the side coming out to the room, because the room is more important than the closet, but the closet's important for the clothes. Most people assume that you put it on the right side going into the closet, but there are those who hold otherwise. And Rabbi Greenblatt, just a small tshuva, he just says that he cites the view that you put it on the side of the right side, because Ramosha, Ramosha gave a similar case, but then he said the right side. He thinks it should be the right side. Now, that's the most opinions. It's the right side. Sometimes you need to bring the rabbi over your house, because it's hard to know which side is the mezuzah side. You have, let's say, a living room that goes into a dining room. And they never say put it on both sides. They'll pick a side and you put it on. If you're not sure, someone I know moved into my town recently, so they had one of the rabbis come to their house and walk through it and tell them where the mezuzah goes. We all have mezuzah on their front door. Here, I'll tell you something. Remember Rav Abadi, who we spoke about so much? I heard this from my Baruch Simon. Baruch Simon, the big chassid of his. If you go to, this is Lakewood, Ir HaTorah, Lakewood. You go to Rav Abadi's house, the Posek's house, there's no mezuzah on his front door. Why is there no mezuzah on his front door? Because you walk in, it's like a tiny, some people have this, you walk in the door and it's a tiny little, I don't know what you call it in English, where you walk in before you get into the house. Then there's another door. It's like you walk in, you're inside, and then there's another door, you walk in the house. Anteroom. Vestibule. But a tiny thing, just like a 3 feet. So he says he has no mezuzah on the first one. You'd think he'd put a mezuzah up and just have even no coffin. So look. So I asked Rabbi Simon, why not just put it there for show? He says, what do you need to put it for show? It's the halacha says you don't need it, so he doesn't put it there. All our shuls have mezuzahs, right? Come with me to Prague. You'll see the Altnoy shul. Oldest continuously functioning shul in the world. There's no a mezuzah on the Altnoy shul because we know that shuls don't need a mezuzah. Now they put mezuzahs on, but they don't make a bracha. So that's the tshuva of Rabbi Greenblatt. Now we have a tshuva of Rabbi Menashe Klein. Pull up Rabbi Menashe Klein. Rabbi Menashe Klein, who in his Hebrew writings calls himself Menashe HaKatan, because Katan in German and Yiddish is Klein. We spoke a lot about him early on. Rabbi Gemara was on, who Rabbi Gemara's son, who he's related to him, and he explained to me why he was buried in Sfat, and you can go online, I did earlier today, and you could see a picture of the funeral in Eretz Yisrael. I didn't even mention, I think, when we spoke about him, I said that he was with Elie Wiesel in Buchenwald. He also survived Auschwitz, as with Elie Wiesel. They both were in Auschwitz as well. So the next tshuva, this is 58. This is the second to last tshuva before, third to last before we finish Yoredeya. Are you obligated to place a mezuzah in an area where you think they might steal it? Where they might even, it could be stolen. You can get rid of now Menashe HaKatan coin. I'm not going to repeat all the things I said about these great rabbanim. The second time I deal with them, you can go back earlier. And although if you go on YouTube and on the Torah Motion website, it doesn't describe what's in the classes, just says class 1, 2, 3. But if you have the book, you can easily find it because I announced the numbers. And that was the first class, actually. There's a lot, suffice to say, there's a lot to say about Menashe Klein, really an incredible Talmud Chacham. The background to this tshuva is as follows. It's dated in 1987. Otofshin Memzayin, so that's January, or maybe, I guess it's January 1987. I was a student in Brandeis University then. Let's see, 67. Yeah, a student there, sophomore year. It was Brandeisians. I was living in East in a single. Probably 70% or 65% of the campus is Jewish. I put up a mezuzah on my door, my dorm room. A couple days later, my mezuzah is gone, stolen. So I go to the Israel Bookshop in Brookline, and I put up another mezuzah. The Israel Bookshop is still around. It survived. I encourage everyone to support it. There aren't many of these stores left. I just bought when I thought my daughter was going to be in college, so I had to get a mezuzah. So I did what I always did. I contacted Israel Bookshop, and they sent me a nice mezuzah because I feel you have to support these stores that actually exist, not just in a warehouse, but a store. So and I used to live there. I worked there when I was to make money in the summer when I lived in Brookline. So anyone who needs any mezuzahs or Jewish stuff, Israel Bookshop. So I went to the Israel Bookshop and I picked up another mezuzah and I put it on my door and lo and behold, another few days, mezuzah stolen. Twice the mezuzah stolen. Was it a Jew, a self-hating Jew? Was it a non-Jew? Wow. So I write to Rabbi Menashe Klein. What do I do here? Do I need to put up a third mezuzah? First of all, it's a question of money. Do I need to buy it? Is this chazakah? It's only twice, not three times that it's going to be stolen. And then there's a question of bizayon. If the non-Jew is going to take it, if he's going to steal it, I don't think he's stealing it to put it on his own door. I think he's stealing it. Who knows what they're going to do with it? There were non-Jews in the past who respected mezuzahs a lot. They thought it was like an amulet, a kameya. And there's a tshuva, I think it's in the Maharil, where he talks about whether you can give a mezuzah to a non-Jewish ruler. And as I recall, he says if he's going to treat it properly, you can. But that's not the issue. So Rabbi Klein says, he quotes the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeya Resh Pei Vav. What places need a mezuzah? He says that your houses, but not just your houses, the gates getting into let's say, courtyards, even gates getting into a city. Jews would have their own cities. Some of you have been with me to Eisenstadt. That was a Jewish town until I think 1921. with a door. Prague used to have a door. Boskovitz, when I say a Jewish town, including their own fire chief. Everything was run by the Jews. So you need to have a mezuzah. However, the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah then says, only if it, because the Shulchan Aruch says, opinion is also if it's two Jews own it, you need to have a mezuzah. But if you have a house and it's shutfim of Yisroel and Ovdei Kochavim, not Jews and non-Jews, then you're putter from mezuzah. You're putter, but it's still a nice thing to do. If you have a non-Jewish roommate, you could put a mezuzah, but you're putter, it says. And also chatzeros nairos, if you have a chatzer, a courtyard. Think of those European courtyards leaning into it, or the gate of a city, but not Jews run the city, but non-Jews live in it. In Eisenstadt, Jews ran it, but not, there was always some non-Jews living in it. Paturim mezuzah, you don't need to have a mezuzah on that, the courtyard, to the mezuzah of the courtyard or the city. And why not? And the Shachi says that even if a majority are Jews, you're putter, why? Mishum sakana, because of danger. This might be one of those things that if there's no danger, then we'd say you're chayim. But and then the Taz, he quotes the Shach, he says, this is the reason why there's no mezuzah in the Shari Rehovot, in the city gates of Krakow and Prague. Remember, these have gates that were closed at night. They could carry on Shabbos. They were completely closed, but you had some non-Jews living inside there. And they didn't put mezuzahs on that, even though it was a ghetto, you often had some non-Jews living in there. Sometimes in Venice, it might only be the guy who's in charge of opening the doors, but in many of the ghettos, you would have some non-Jews living in. And even if not, if it's outside and they could get to it, you wouldn't have it. Why does it say they never put a mezuzah up? Because of sakana. They would say that this is, they would use it as, they would say it's Jewish magic or it's all sorts of things. I'm not sure really what the sakana of putting it up was, but then he gives another reason why we wouldn't put a mezuzah on the gate, let's say, of the city, because they certainly, bevada yitlua v'yivzua, the non-Jews are going to take it. There's no question that they're going to take it and they're going to be mevaza it, they're going to degrade it, do all sorts of terrible things. And therefore, we would we'd be responsible for that. He continues that what would Jews do? He gives another example how they would treat the mezuzah improperly. So if you're afraid they're going to treat it improperly, you don't need to put a mezuzah up. In fact, not only you shouldn't put a mezuzah up. And Rabbi Klein concludes from this, we learn from this, Mefurash, Dibimkom Sheish Regilus, where we see that there is it's happening. It's not just one time that the non-Jews are going to take the mezuzah, your putter. So then the question is, well, is two times enough? And he says, since they took it twice already, Lichora Nira Dehu Makom HaRegel Akach Mezuzah. So it appears that this is the place they're going to take the mezuzah. And he says, when he deal with issues of Isser, he says, we assume that Shtei Pamim is a Chazakah. Three times if you're doing something positively. But if it's from deal with Isser, twice is a Chazakah. And then he says that if you think it's non-Jews, you don't put them as those up because we're afraid they're going to take it and they could degrade it. But he says, but if you're afraid, if it's a Jewish thief, in Brandeis it might have been a Jewish thief, who would then sell it, he thinks you have to put a mezuzah up because it's not going to come to be Zion and there's no danger. Today I think any Jew who would steal a mezuzah, I don't think they're going to steal it to sell it. And no college student, I should say. I hate to say it, but we do know about Jews who have stolen mezuzahs, who've stolen Sifrei Torah, and they've stolen it to sell it, to make money. There was a huge scandal in Gibraltar where from people who were made believe, where they joined the kollel to learn. So they got access to the shul and they stole all the gold and the silver stuff. So we have plenty of examples. There have been other terrible things where Jews have dealt with stolen Sifrei Torah, but that wasn't the case there. So I didn't put up another mezuzah that year. And then he concludes and says that in Jerusalem, however, he says there's no doubt that if you're afraid it's going to be degraded, they're going to steal it, they're going to burn it, you know, they'll do all sorts of terrible stuff with the mezuzah. You don't put a mezuzah. But he says, when I was in Jerusalem, I saw in the old houses that were built years ago, what they would do is they would, some of you have probably seen this as well, the only thing you see is the Shin Dalad Yud. The entire mezuzah is covered by concrete. And just at the very top of it, there's a hole, and you could see the mezuzah in there. That's not what normally we speak of when they did put the hole in the wall on the side there, and you put the mezuzah in. He's talking about, which I've seen as well, where it's covered up completely, basically, so it can't be stolen. And then he says, if you could do that, which obviously you can't do, can't start the college dorm, you can't even nail it in. You have to use that tape stuff that does, which they sell. Then you should do that, but otherwise, so this is halacha maisa. I mentioned already, there's a number of cases dealing with Brandeis. We saw the more interesting, perhaps, cases with Rabbi Axelrod, calling him up for an aliyah, getting a minyan. Do you wait for the minyan and miss him on tefillah, or do you daven b'chidus? Then this is another case that I think, as I recall, there's one more Brandeis where mezuzah is being stolen from that Brandeis University, and halacha maisa, you don't need to put up another mezuzah. I see we have two more questions in your idea. One very interesting from Chaim Rappaport. We haven't really spoken about Chaim Rappaport just a bit, so we'll introduce you to who this great Chaim Rappaport is, great Talmud Chacham is, about the Rambam and superstition. And we'll conclude with, again, with Rav Tzabi, a whole thing about a chiddush of Rav Kook on living in Egypt and what Rav Tzabi has to say about that. And then we'll get to Evan Ezer with that that tshuva, which when I set up the sefer, I didn't think it was radical at all. I thought it was unusual, but not radical. And but two separate dayanim have said that this is quite interesting. And I'll explain to you exactly why and what he quotes from Rav Moshe. And then we'll get into Rav Yosef Masas, women's hair covering, mechitza, and the Eda. I will bring back from the dead the Eda organization, because there's about five tshuvot that were requested. They requested that I solicit from the rabbis for Eda. If you don't know what Eda is, stay tuned for next week. So the questions, Shiner's, I see Shiner's back. He was the one that reminded me of Rav Nata Greenblatt, that great video, if you haven't seen it from last week, that of quoting Rav Moshe Soloveitcher about Reb Chaim. Now, I was wondering, Shiner, I didn't see him last week. He just got back from the Ukraine. They went to the tour of the Kvarim of all the Gedolim, the Hasidic Rebbeim, and I was surprised because I didn't know that you can go anywhere in Europe, but Ukraine you can go. So if you have this great desire, the summer's not ended, unfortunately Torah in Motion's not taking you anywhere, if you want to get away, you can go to Uman, you can go to Mezhebuz, you can go to all those places. And if you're really interested, you be in touch with me and I'll put you in touch with Shiner. Al-Gabarach says Pollar is correct. That's the Rebbetzin was Matterstorfer. Yeah, no, he comes from Brisk. He was a Talmud Mufak of the Brisker Rav, this idea of the fasting. They have this idea that if you can't learn on Tzom Gedalia, better to eat a little and then you can learn well. But that's not the standard halacha, as far as I know. Is there any truth to the legend that the Rogachev learned on Tisha B'Av because he needed to learn? Yes, yeah, Shiner, go back to my post. He did learn on Tisha B'Av. And he said that the Malkus they give me will be worth it. That is, the Torah is worth it. It's worth it to sin in this matter to learn Torah. It's an unbelievable thing. The Chazon Ish is quoted as saying that this sin is no different than any other sin. But the Rogatchover said, I'd rather sin and be punished for this sin of learning Torah. The Rogatchover is unbelievable. If you haven't seen my piece in the Jewish Review Books on the Rogatchover, I found an interview in Yiddish, an interview with the Rogatchover. Can you imagine the Gadol Shmedoyim, the Rogatchover, gave an interview in Yiddish. So you can just search Mark Shapiro, the Rogatchover, and you'll get my post, which deals with fasting. And I also deal with the Tisha B'Av, the Rogatchover. The reason I dealt with it is because it's antinomian. You have this conception, which I'm going to get to in a future blog, where sometimes rabbis go beyond the letter of the law for the law. And that's sort of like the fasting as well. You don't fast because you're doing something greater, but you can't put this in print and you can't make this a rule for everyone. So, but then, yes, the Rogatchover, Now, some people claim that the rugged shover, well, there's a Yerushalmi that says that an Avel, he learned in Aveiros. Forget to take away Tisha B'Av, Aveiros, that's what he learned. Others learned on Tisha B'Av. And they say, well, there's a Yerushalmi based on it. It's not true. We have the rugged shover said, I'll be punished for this, but it's okay. It's worth it. Reb Baruch says that the V'chaim Brisker was Machmer B'Kuach Nefesh. Yeah, that's 100%. That's what it comes down to. Rav Schechter says that he left a tzava that they shouldn't fast on these fast days because they were very concerned. It's almost neurotic, the concern they have, because you can fast. It's not so terrible. We fast all the time. We seem to be able to make it. But the Briskers were very concerned with, wait till my next blog post. Rav Chaim Brisker said that he'd rather not, if World War One, when World War One broke out, someone came into the Beis Medrash and said, and this is quoted supposedly reliably, said that this is, it's got to be Milchamas Gog Magog, that this is the final great war. It's going to lead the Mashiach. And the man was very excited, and other people were very excited. Mashiach's coming. And Reb Chaim said, I don't want Mashiach. Wait a minute, what, he doesn't want Mashiach. He says, if Mashiach has to come because of one Jew being killed, then I don't want Mashiach. He can go back to where he is. So for Briskers, human life is above all else. So that, but that's like the Ish HaLacha of Rav Chaim Brisker. Everyone's excited. The war's great starting. Maybe this is gonna, but Rav Chaim's looking at it, well, someone's gonna die. And the Brisker Rav follows this. The Brisker Rav was a complete anti-Zionist. And it had nothing to do with the Gimel Shavuos of the Satmar Rebbe or anything like that. It was always very simple. He said, this is gonna lead to Jews dying. And it did lead to Jews dying. Of course, we can say that many more Jews would die if you didn't have a state. And others held that it's a Mechamas Mitzvah, so people died. But that's what happens in war. But the Brisker Rav said that since people will die, we can do this. We'd rather live among the Goyim and not have... That's Brisk. At least that's Reb Chaim Brisker. It's not the Rav. The Rav felt differently. Ellen says, many decades ago, Rabbi Rieger allowed campers at Yavne to daven Mincha and end the fast of the 17th of Tevet. Probably because he thought that they were getting weak and things. Maybe, I don't know, it was a general rule. You're saying it's a general rule. That's like with the guy who said to me, the Mechaber Sefer, that we're weak today and we don't do it. This year they did. This year the camps that were in session said that we're not going to fast. We're going to end around Mincha time. There were some camps that went. It's hard to know whether that's okay. Shiner, if there's some legend, he says, yes, so Baruch says Echonesis. He's ready to accept the punishment. Do I have any thoughts on the passing of Rav Steinsaltz? It's almost hard to speak about Rav Steinsaltz. Rav Steinsaltz, I don't want to compare him to the Rambam because no one can compare him to the Rambam, but it is unimaginable almost that one individual could accomplish so much in his lifetime. Single-handedly to translate the Talmud. And then he did all this other stuff. But single-handedly to translate the Talmud, this is a feat. It's beyond how he could accomplish that. And it's unbelievable. Take a look. Last week, Rav Mazuz has a couple things said about him and how, you know, the Litvish tried to tear him down and everything. But the Eda Charedit, you can read that in Kikar Shabbat also, they refused to. Because the Eda Charedit recognized how great he was. He wasn't a posek, he didn't do psak, but just in terms of what he was able to achieve, it's mind-boggling. It really is. And of course, we didn't recognize it, we didn't appreciate it. Some did, but most didn't appreciate it during when he was here. You never appreciate it when they're here. In 20 years, in 50 years, we'll appreciate much more. But he walked among us till recently, and he just accomplished so much. Are Vasily Hildesheimer's Chuvas available in an updated edition? I don't know why you ask an updated edition. The edition that came out in the late 60s. It's a beautiful print. Unless you mean a reprint. It hasn't been reprinted. You can see it on Otzer HaChachma. I don't know about HebrewBooks.org, but we don't need an updated edition. It's a beautiful edition. Please don't lower my voice. Okay, I didn't know I was lowering it. Rav Chaim Dov Keller, who's just nifter, he's also a big Talmid Chacham, and he's remembered, unfortunately, he'll be remembered for him and Dr. Lamb going at each other about modern orthodoxy. Rav Keller, unfortunately, said some things, negative things about modern orthodoxy. It's unfortunate, I say, because that's what he'll be remembered by many people. When there's a lot more to, I didn't know him personally, but it's obviously, it's a great loss to tell Chicago and the Torah world as a whole. Howard says they haven't been reprinted. Yes, they haven't been, and they weren't Machon Yerushalayim. The Chidushim are Machon Yerushalayim. The Tshuvot are these black volumes. I only have one of them. I was only able to find one in the bookstore. The other one I use on Otzer HaChachma. Ivanka Trump, Jewish or not. 100% Jewish. Jewish is you and me. Most famous Jew in the world. Yes, Rav Kahana was involved in the era of Machlokas before the war. Rav Chaim Ozer supported the Erev in Warsaw. Rav Yashav's viewpoint is interesting because Rav Yashav says in a tshuva that the Batei Din rely on Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, that even if people know they're going to violate certain laws, not generally, but L'tayavon, they'll violate things, including Shabbos, that it's still valid. But we definitely, when he left the Rabbanut, he was very stringent and said that believed in revoking conversions. I don't know how long, but he was the reason, Rabbi Sherman claimed at least, that this was Rabbi Yosha's position. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, this is also very interesting. He signed declarations stating that Kabbalah's mitzvos are necessary, absolutely, even b'diavad, etc. And yet we have other texts of his in which he says, shows b'diavad that if you don't observe it, he would still accept you, it's still a valid conversion. Rav Yoel Amital, as I recall, the son of Rav Amital, he works at Shalvim, but he's the son of Rav Amital from the Gush. He has an article in Hamayan in which he argues that this is an example of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, for the sake of peace, agreeing to go along with Rav Shach and others in the Stipler with a very stringent view on conversion. See, Rav Gorin had a very liberal view on conversion, basically like Rav Uziel, and this engendered a very harsh response by Rav Shach and the Stipler. So where Rav Amital claims that he went along with them, but we have actual documents from Rav Shlomo Zalman that he's sort of more in the middle, like Rav Unterman. Rav Unterman said that in Eretz Yisrael we can be more equal than we could in Liverpool because they're growing up in a Jewish environment, et cetera, et cetera. So you have all these viewpoints. David says, Rav Gorin conducted meticulous research and conclusively find that the first husband of the mother of Langerbrunn, the sister, never underwent a valid conversion, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that's not what Shiner was asking about, David. He wasn't asking about the Langer case. We have the great irony, though, that Rabbi Gorin said that the Langer case, this woman who was married to a guy who converted, and then they got divorced, and then she remarried and had children, and the Rabbanut declared the children mamzerim, and Rav Gorin was able to free them from the taint of mamzeris by saying that the first husband was never really Jewish. Now, Rav Gorin was attacked by the right wing in particular. They said that you can never revoke a conversion. It's a great irony that Rav Mazuz actually points out in his Haskama to Rav Amsalam. It's a great irony because today it's the right wing revoking conversions. And there they said to Rav Gorin, you can never revoke a conversion. And the truth is, this was a distortion because Rav Gorin never revoked a conversion. He does cite the Rugachever as like a sniff, because the Rugachever holds you can revoke a conversion. But the main thing Rav Gorin showed is that there's no reason to believe that this man ever converted. We have testimony he went to church. He didn't even know Shema. There was no evidence. They couldn't provide the name of a rabbi who converted him. So when you're dealing with a case of Mamzerus, there's reason you'd think to be Mako. But many respected post-scheme, as Shiner says, including people, I've said this before, Rav Avad Yosef, find me a time when Rav Avad Yosef does not find a kula on a case like this. He was unable to find the kula. Rav Shal Yisraeli is not a Haredi, he's America's Arav, he's really a Zionist. He cares as much as Rav Gorin about the state of Israel. There was the threat because the Golda Meir was going to institute civil marriage if they couldn't find a heter. Rav Shal Yisraeli was just as concerned about this. Rav Jolti, those were the three people on the Beistin, Rav Jolti, Rav Shal Yisraeli, and Rav Avad Yosef, and they could not find a heter. Rav Avadya accepted Rav Gorin's view after the fact. It shows you it's not a simple case at all. And then David replies, you can read about it. David says, just to read you, Rav, those who disagreed with him, Rav Yashav also disagreed. They didn't present compelling arguments, and the dispute was ad hominem against Rav Gorin. after Avgorin issued it, it was ad hominem. But don't forget, it went to the Supreme Court of Supreme Rabbinic Court based in Agadol. And you had three great dayanim, Rav Avadia, Rav Shel Yisraeli, and Rav Jolti. And Ney could not find a heter. Then Rav Gorin set up his own basin of 10 dayanim. We now know who a number of them were. Some of them said who they were. I know that Rav Henk, I have to disagree with you, David. You say it's worth noting that Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Henkin both reviewed his psak and said they concurred with his conclusions. I don't know anything about Rav Soloveitchik. I've never heard that he said he concurred with it. Rav Henkin definitely never reviewed the psak. Rav Henkin was basically blind at the time. What Rav Henkin said, and this is quoted by his grandson in his book, was that Rav Gorin is a Godol Bisro, he's the Mara de Asra, and we have to accept his ruling. But since the other Gedolim disagree, we can't apply his logic to all the other cases. But in this case, we have to accept Rav Gorin's psak. So Rav Henkin accepted Rav Gorin's psak, but not because he concurred with his conclusions. He really never read the conclusions. He said that Rav Gorin, as a Gadol Yisrael, we have to accept, if he tells us that he investigated it and he has a based in, we have to accept it. The other 10 Dayanim were afraid to make their names known. They didn't want to be destroyed, but Rav Gorin was brave enough to do that. So that's the case. In the Rav Gorin talks, you can hear more about that. Is there any truth to the story that the Rambam would write in his letters that when he lived in Egypt, he was violating several lavim by living there? We'll come back to this when we talk next week, when I really deal with the issue of living in Egypt. That is mentioned in the Kafter Vaferach of Rav Shor HaParchi, and no, there's no proof at all. In fact, it's completely false. It's a myth. We have plenty of letters in the Rambam. He never says that. And why would the Rambam ever say that he violated a law by living there? So it's not true. What's your source with that the Rav agreed with Rav Gorin? David Eisen will have to tell us. Rav Kefet says, okay, so you have to find out. Rav Kefet was living in Israel at the time. So we'd have to know whether what the Rav supposedly said, or he's quoted as saying, I don't have to say supposedly, there's no reason why I think not, is that Rav Gorin's logic makes a lot of sense. And I have to tell you, I read through most of Rav Gorin's work. I can't help but thinking that if Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach wrote that, no one would have attacked it. You have to understand that Rav Gorin had already given a number of very unusual rulings, and this was really the icing on the cake, and they already were against him. They thought that he became chief rabbi because he agreed with Golda Meir to come up with a heter. They didn't like him, they didn't want him, and this just gave him the opportunity. If Rav Moshe had issued the same ruling, I don't think anyone would have batted an eye. Beis HaKnesses, Baruch says, yeah, Pater from mezuzah, Beis Medrash Chayev. But in shuls all over the place, they have mezuzahs on it. Now, Baruch says, not all shuls have mezuzahs. You're right, but many shuls do have mezuzahs. Who were the three rabbis presiding over Ivanka's conversion? I don't feel comfortable getting into, it's a private thing. She's a Jew like all of us, and we have to be very careful. How many is it, 35, 36? You don't oppress the ger, and I do feel strongly that looking into her conversion and saying things would violate oppressing the ger. And neither she nor Jared, who he certainly should be in the running, I think, for a Nobel Peace Prize. Anyone, if Obama could be nominated after 10 days of president, well, but he'll never get it, obviously, because of who his father-in-law is. But they never chose to be in the limelight. They're not out there as Orthodox spokesmen. It was all idiotic when they became president, everyone looking up to them as some sort of Orthodox role models. And then if they didn't live up to it, if you saw a video or a picture or this, they never asked that. They're simple balabatim. Upper East Side they were living on. So it's not, I don't think any of us should be talking about them. And they're in our community. So you don't have to agree with their politics, but they're they send their kids to Jewish school, they're big Balei Tzedakah, and they're part of our community. None of us are perfect, and so let's leave it at that. If the mezuzah encased in concrete, it could never be checked. No, I think it probably, well, you could pull it off, I guess. Or maybe where the Shin Dalet Yud is, maybe you could pull that off and just lift out the cloth. It's a good question. He says, Rav Menashe Klein in his tshuva, I'll read you the exact words here. He says, Yes, so you can leave enough that you can pull out the cloth. I'll say something which I tell my groups all the time. When we go to Cordoba, for instance, we should see the mezuzah. The mezuzah is facing straight up, like the Sephardim do, and we see other mezuzahs in the wall. And I always ask people then, how often do you need to check the mezuzah? And people always, there's always someone who knows it twice every 7 years. Very strange lashon. Why not say every third and a half year? And then I say, well, how often to check a tefillin? And people give all sorts of reasons. And usually there's someone in the audience that says never, which is the truth. You never need to check a mezuzah. It's a good, a tefillin. It's a good idea to check it the first time you get it to make sure it's actually there. But we assume that since you're using it, you know, if you weren't using it, if you had it for 20 years, you need to check it. If you're using it, there's no bugs or anything to get inside. So what's the reason you have to check the mezuzah? Because of insects or the weather, whatever it is. That raises the question, what about indoors? Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach holds, and then after I said this on one of the trips, Rabbi Kelmanser Schachter holds the same thing, that if you have a mezuzah inside, remember, you could have a manuscript. I could have a manuscript from the Dead Sea Scrolls here in my house with the proper temperature. It could last 1,000 years. Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Schachter also hold that mezuzahs inside don't need to be checked at all because we don't need to be concerned about that. So I'm not saying you should follow it, but it's a limud schus because it's very rare in my experience to find people who actually check their mezuzahs every 3.5 years. And according to Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Abadi and Rav Schachter and many others, you don't need to. What about the mezuzah outside? That presumably you would, but Rav Abadi holds no. He holds that even outside our mezuzahs, we put them much stronger than the olden days. And I don't know how often you need to, but the Rugged Shaver was a Chabad Chassid. Yes, the Rugged Shaver was Chabad. He was not Lubavitch. He was from Kapus or Babruisk. And he was the Rav in Divinsk of the Hasidic community. Although the Babruisker Rebbe was not such a fan of the Rugged Shaver, it seems. We have information that's come out in print that he told his Hasidim when it came to Psak, even though the Rugged Shaver was the Rav, and the Rugged Shaver was a Babroisker, to go to the Rameir Simcha for Psak. Because the Rugged Shaver's Psak was unusual, let's put it that way. He didn't follow the Shulchan Aruch, all sorts of things. Three more things we have here, four more. David says, Eisen, Brisker is being lenient with other fast days, excluding Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. Remember, the Rav Schachter writes that according to Rav Chaim, even Tisha B'Av, he doesn't think that we should have to fast. But in practice, everyone fasts Tisha B'Av. Rav Meir Lichtenstein quoted his grandfather, the Rav, who claimed that the Brisker tradition is based on the Ramban, that half fast days are not real fasts and only full fast days are legitimate fasts. There's another thing, that there's a Meiri who writes that, I forget his logic, who explains that basically today we shouldn't fast on those fast days other than Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. Rabbi Ben, what's his name? The super Zionist Rabbi Machon Shilo. I forgot his name. If you never heard of Machon Shilo, you go online. David Bar Chaim. He's trying to create an Eretz Yisrael. He's from Australia, but he's been in Israel for many years. An Eretz Yisrael Judaism. Completely Eretz Yisrael. So you can be Kitnios. He's a big Talmud Chacham. And he holds that today there's no fast days other than Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, because he holds we're in Eretz Yisrael now, we control the land, and if you look in the Meiri and other sources, they all assume we shouldn't. There's a joke I heard from one of my Haredi friends. This is a joke in Lakewood, another Haredi Shiva, is about Som Gedalia, that why should I fast in Som Gedalia? Gedalia wouldn't have fasted for me if I was killed. But it's a joke. Another joke I'll tell you, that Ruve from Paris told me that he heard in the yeshiva when he was there that, just give the joke because it's, since you mentioned it, where did I put the page here? I'll record this. This is the joke in the brisk that the Brisker girls and wives do fast. Since the only reason why the man doesn't fast on, let's say, Shabbos or Tammuz is because they have to learn, but the girls are not learning, so they do fast. It's a joke, obviously. In the Haredi world in general, the Chassidish world, I should say, women don't fast on a lot of these fastings. They do fast on Tisha B'Av. They don't fast on the other ones, even though according to Halakha, they're supposed to fast. So you can ask pregnant women. According to halacha, pregnant women are supposed to fast, but you find kulas, especially Diane Fisher from the Yedda Charedis and others came up with unbelievable kulas for pregnant women. So ask your local rabbi. I'm just telling you, I find it a fascinating phenomenon that is sort of in the shadows, this idea that the fasting is not something, and it's a limud schus. For a lot of people don't fast on these little fast days. We know a lot of people don't. The Ben Ish Chai already mentions that people don't fast. He's talking in Baghdad. So if you can find a limud schus, maybe it's nice. I never had any personal interaction with Rabbi Steinsaltz, no correspondence. He wasn't a posek, and he was very busy. I once, on the Upper West Side, I had Shabbos meal with a family that was one of his big backers. What was the reaction of the Yedda Charedis? Now they passed away. I didn't see a reaction. I don't read their newspapers. I can tell you, though, that they were the ones, when Rav Shach demanded that his books be put in Chayram, the Yedda Charedis looked at it, and they said, well, there's a couple of things he wrote in his book on the biblical figures, change that. And they refused. And when they refused to go along with them, the Yatei Ne'eman started attacking the Yedda Charedis as not going with the Das Torah. But the Yedda Charedis' response was that they have their own Das Torah. They don't need to follow the Yatei Ne'eman's Das Torah. Yes, David Eisen calls attention to Eitam Henkin's article on his grandfather's great-grandfather's position on Rav Gorin's Pesach on the Langer case. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, and the way I explained it is exactly what he says. And David says, Rabbi Arachai's position is well-grounded. Yes, I don't even remember the details of the Gemara, but when I remember reading it, it is well-grounded. But you're not going to have that. When the State of Israel was first founded, you had this group called, David, help me here. What's the group that Rabbi Rosenthal, Kibbutz Adati, yes, Kibbutz Adati. They were very liberal Zionists, religious Zionists. Their argument was that we shouldn't have these fast days anymore. Tisha B'Av they would keep, but the others, really, we've passed them by. And it's fine. You have the Briskers and others who have these interesting practices. But I think, as far as I know, despite Rabbi Bar Chaim's position in the Torah world, everyone feels you have to fast. Now, if you can't do it, if it's too difficult for you, okay. So you don't do it on the littler ones. So a lot of people, it's more difficult. You can find a head there. But the idea that you tell people, Chachila, you don't need to, that has not been accepted. And yes, exactly, iPad, Ein Shalom versus Ein Shmad, etc. And finally, someone raised me privately that one of Samuel Hyman's books, the person learned that women in the Haredi world only fast half a day. In the Hasidic world, Beis Yaakov girls, many of them do not fast at all on these Shivas or Tammuz. They like to criticize the modern Orthodox world. My daughter was at Lindenbaum last year, so I asked her, what about the fast day? The little Asar B'Teva, she says, of course, we all fasted. They didn't even tell them not to, and yet if she'd be at the Beis Yaakov down the street, certainly the Hasidic Beis Yaakovs, it wouldn't have been a question they wouldn't have fasted. Also davening. At the Haredi world, women don't daven. In the modern Orthodox world, even if they're not mechuyav, but textually they are mechuyav for Shacharis, probably mincha as well. So it goes together with empowering women to learn. So once you empower them, it's led to the interesting phenomenon that they're actually more makbid on halachot in Lindenbaum, which I think is, I don't know if it's maybe called on the left. I'm not sure. It's a serious place. I don't really know if it's on the left or the center. It's no more left than Migdal Oz. They believe in, you know, women should be able to do anything, you know, in terms of learning. So my daughter comes home and she's telling me, you know, all about, like, she thinks I didn't know it. Believe me, I know it. But that women should have mezuzah. That three women should have a mezuzah. So I said, no, you're right. We three women should. But of course, in the Haredi world, you're not going to have three women. Even though Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says it's halacha pesuka, it's black letter law, in the RCA's new sitter, they say, and in the defense, they say that you should have a mezuzah, three women, and Rav Shlomo Zalman says, and they defend themselves saying, because someone wrote a review saying that the RCA sitter has feminist sentiments. Which basically just means they pay attention to the women's issue. But in the latest Hakira, they say, no, it's not about feminism. This is the Pesach of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Nonsense. Of course it's about feminism. For hundreds of years, the women, despite what the Halacha said, they didn't do it. They didn't do the mezuzah. Now we're more attentive to women. We saw Rav Mesas. We're more attentive to women's learning. We're more attentive to women, you know, being responsible for their own reshus and halacha. So now we do this halacha. Of course it's there. It's not being made up. It's not like some egalitarian minion or anything, but to say that it just came out of the blue because people looked at Halacha, no, no. It's feminism, but for those people who don't like the word feminism, it's feminism in a good way. If the Halacha says women should do it, how could you say it's bad? So that's how I put it. Finally, it's not a full, Baruch says, a full-fledged endorsement of Rav Sanz Eda. The Eda were not Steinsaltz people. Steinsaltz was a Chabadnik. But they did not believe he should be put in Cherim. So we talk about how the Eda are extreme. That was a case where the Eda actually had their head on straight. And Rabbi Steinsaltz said, you're right. What was what I wrote in the book? He basically described the avos in human ways, which, okay, in an English book you get it, but in Hebrew it does. So he agreed to change it. If you asked him privately, he probably would say, well, it's better to change it than to make machokas. But and then the Litvisha world, they started looking at all of his commentaries. They started trying to find things to destroy him. And what did he do? What did the great Rabbi Steinsaltz do? He didn't do anything. That they decided for whatever that they're going to destroy him, and Rabbi Mazuz says that when someone called him up and said, "Did you hear what they're doing to you?" He said, "You know, he just ignored it. He was a biker of Cook. You know, it just bounced off him. What does he need to worry about what they're saying? He accomplished great things. Okay, he called Shimshon a brute. You said, well, I'd like to know what the Hebrew is, and so does Rashbam." Okay, so if he made a mistake, we've all made mistakes in our language. So the Eda called him in. The Eda said, he said, oh, you're right. So he changed the wording. So you got to put him in Cherem. You got to declare him an apikoros. You have to throw him out of Kol Yisrael because he made a word wrong. It's just, as Rav Mazuz said in the newsletter last week, we have to get off this thing where religious Jews try to destroy other religious Jews. Like it's a sport now to destroy them. Okay. Well, thank you all. This was very nice, and God willing, we'll pick up next week. Rabbi.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. I liked your passion thing. The defense of Ivanka Trump, I think, was very nice. If I could.
We don't check people's tzitzis, even if the woman's wearing a tzitzis.
Right. Okay. Very good. Okay. Thank you very much.